In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about plateauing at 1K MRR, when to spend on SaaS apps, and more listener questions. And I also ask Mike a question right at the start that I haven't prepped him for.
Damn you.
Mike, what is the most interesting book you've read lately?
Ooh, good one. The one that I read recently was one that you had talked about on the podcast. It was Masters of Doom.
What'd you think?
I thought it was really interesting. The story and the dynamics between the two Johns was very personal between them, obviously. And then the implosion of the John Romero's company afterwards, after they blew all that money that had come in and basically bankrupted the company. And that was interesting, but not necessarily unsurprising.
Yeah, it's like they were kids, essentially, starting a company and making millions of dollars. And they didn't they buy like Lamborghinis or Ferraris? I mean, just the total stereotypical, like 20-something with too much money.
Yeah, but that was with their money that they got from Doom. It was John Romero had spent like ungodly amounts of money on building the company and on office space in downtown, I think, Dallas or Austin or something like that.
Right, where he raised 10 or 20 million to start the new gaming company after they split.
Yep.
And yeah, then it's crazy.
Blew, like, I don't know, what was it, 20 or 30, $40 million or something like that. And they had $100 million of guaranteed money coming if they actually just published
crazy.
The games. But
I know. It's nuts.
So that was my most interesting book recently.
Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we made. So where this week, sir?
Well, I decided to let you back on the podcast after the date fiasco. Did you hear that?
No, I didn't. I haven't heard it yet. Oh, but did you tell the story? Oh, how the MicroConf saved the date that I said like 3 weeks ago was wrong. But did you tell anyone what I was reading? I was reading stuff you typed in the doc.
I did.
You typed it.
I know, but I absolutely did not say that to anybody.
Oh, man. So that's where it comes out now. I said the wrong date. So it seemed like I was wrong. Oh, I did hear you say that at the beginning of the next episode. I was like, oh, that sucks. How did we do that?
Yeah, it was totally my calendar.
That's funny.
But you're the one who said it, not me.
I know. It will forever go down. I wonder if I can get Josh to go back and edit that episode.
He probably could, but people have already listened to it, so it's too late.
I know. Cool. So the correct dates for MicroConf in Vegas next year, growth will be April 29th through May 1st. Starter edition will be May 1st through 3rd. So mark your calendars. Tickets will be coming out in the next couple weeks.
And I corrected my calendar already.
Good. What else is going on?
Well, my wife, Allie, has, I've talked about a little bit before. She took over another fitness studio here in town. And so it's been about 6 months or so. And there's an article that literally came out today where she was voted the best athletic club in the an annual Reader's Choice survey that went out, like maybe last month. But it came in and she was selected. So just wanted to say kind of congratulations to her.
That's super cool. And you have a little article. You're going to link, see it up in the show notes?
Sure.
Awesome. For me, two kind of random things. One is, have you heard of the Eero routers? It's spelled E-E-R-O.
I think I've seen something about them, but I haven't really looked up on them at all.
If you have the first world problem of having a house so big that you can't get Wi-Fi in your kitchen, then these, or you can't get it at any part of your house, these Eero routers are ridiculous. So they are, you buy them in a 3-pack and they're not cheap. I think it was $300 to $400 on Amazon, and they basically mesh network with one another. And so they don't use Wi-Fi to go through the walls, right? They use a mesh network at a different frequency that can go through walls a lot easier, and you put them around your house. So like I have this house in Minneapolis has a basement and then two stories, and the house is wide. It's like longer than, you know, a lot of houses. So when we first set up just the Netgear router, like you couldn't get Wi-Fi and almost, I mean, really you could get it in that one room and it was blocked everywhere else. With these 3-Eero routers, it is ridiculously fast and everywhere, even way, way down in the basement, which is through like layers and layers of concrete and all this stuff. It's crazy how good these things work. So again, not cheap. You know, a Netgear router that I was using was $80, and this was, like I said, $300 or $400, but it permanently solved this problem. I used to have extenders that were just, you had the underscore EXT network, it's just junk. And there's a couple of these, you know, they've had these for years, obviously for commercial use, like in office spaces and such, college campuses. But the first consumer ones, you know, came out within the last 1 to 2 years, and Aero, just they keep updating the operating system. And I have nothing but good things to say about these guys. They're not sponsoring the podcast, although they probably should. So that's kind of the deal. Do you have any dead spots in your house, or does your kind of Netgear capture everything?
No, see, I cheated and I have a power drill, so I drill holes through walls and run Cat 6 cable.
Oh, really? It seems like something you would do, Mike.
It
seems like you would build your own servers and run Cat 6 cable through things. Oh my goodness! So like we're in a rental, you know, and who knows how long we'll be here, and so it's like
that's what the security deposit's for.
yeah, I'm gonna run cable. But we had, and then even at our house in Fresno, it was a single story, but it was super long. And I could never get Wi-Fi in the living room because the router was over in the office. And so they would have fixed it there as well. So I guess that's it.
Yeah, I do have Wi-Fi here, but it's, let's see here. I think I have 3 different Wi-Fi routers in my house. So like like in each general area, like there's either wired or wireless, depending on where you're at. And of course, to screw with my neighbors who asked if they could borrow my Wi-Fi, I created one called FBI Van 42 or something like that.
If they could borrow your Wi-Fi, wow.
I know. I was like, no.
No, there's no chance that's happening. So my other tidbit is I wanted to run through a couple of books that I've listened to recently and really enjoyed. You know, I still think I keep coming back to my top 3. These are not ones I've listened to recently, but I think my top 2 or 3 audiobooks of all time are Masters of Doom, like I said, you know, and you need to listen to that. And then Hatching Twitter is another one. And then The Snowball with Warren Buffett. And those are all good. But some other ones I've listened to recently that I hold in high regard. One called American Kingpin. And it's by Nick Bilton, who's the same guy who did Hatching Twitter. And it's about Silk Road, the Silk Road, the Bitcoin marketplace that sold drugs. It's about the guy who started it. And it's very, very well written, very compelling, just like Hatching Twitter. So if you haven't, I didn't really have much interest in the story, to be honest. I really didn't care about the Silk Road. I didn't think I was going to care, but he makes you care by the time you're 2 chapters in. So very interesting. And then I listened to Angel by Jason Calacanis. And whether you're an angel investor or not, it's pretty fascinating to hear inside his world. He it's a good balance of boots on the ground stories, advice for angels, advice for founders who may someday raise money, how to run a good company. I mean, it's just a lot of, Calacanis is such a smart dude and has so much experience with this stuff that he almost can't help but learn something from this, even if you're not going to be, you know, an angel investor or seek angel investment. And then another one is called Petty, the biography. And oddly enough, I was listening to this a couple months ago, and then Tom Petty just passed away, you know, within the last month. It was coincidental. I've always been a fan of Tom Petty. I didn't know his story. To be honest, the first at least third of the book is really boring, and I almost skipped out of it. But as I started skipping chapters, and I got to the point where they did start taking off, and it was fascinating from there, like the actual rise of them instead of all the years of him growing up and stuff. It just, that part didn't resonate. And then lastly, there's a new book called From a Certain Point of View that's new on Audible, and it is basically Star Wars Episode 4 told. It's the story of all the surrounding characters, and they got like 40 different writers and then 40 different voice actors to do these little short stories about. So, you know, it might be about a stormtrooper who is off camera, you know, or it's about like a Jawa who like sabotaged something. And it's about when R2 tries to sabotage the red droid and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's all these, it's kind of non-canon, I'm sure, but it's cool if you're a geeky Star Wars fan, and I enjoy listening to it. My 11-year-old listening to it, and I'm listening to it. And then we compare notes, you know, it's like, did you understand that one and what they were saying, that, you know, we kind of talk about it. So that's been fun. Have you listened to any of those or read them?
I saw the From a Certain Point of View had come out, and I keep seeing it in different places, but I hadn't read it or really looked into it. I didn't know the story behind it.
Yeah. So it's interesting if you're a Star Wars geek, and if not, like if you're not going to know, you know, because they make references to like things that unless you've seen Star Wars several times, you're not going to get, and it's not going to be interesting. So
cool.
Today, we are answering listener questions. We still have a good number coming in, so I want to keep up with that. The first question is about plateauing at 1K MRR, and it's a follow-up to a question that Matt Visk had asked a few months ago, and it was regarding PortfolioLounge.com. And he said, thanks for your reply in an earlier episode. I've since listened to most of your past podcasts and realized that funding is not necessarily what I should be looking for. I wanted to clarify and say that PortfolioLounge.com has had about 30,000 free members, and upgraded subscription options average about $10 per month. Sadly, the site has plateaued at around 1K MRR. I'd love to get your advice, see what you think about the site, and, you know, potentially how to grow it. And so what I want to talk about today, we can just bat, I want to bat a few ideas around of like a lot of sites, a lot of people find themselves in this situation. You launch an app, it grows to 1K MRR, and then it plateaus. And it's like, what do you do at that point? How do you attack the plateau? And I think we'd also separately maybe talk about the kind of the free plan, whether we think you should do that moving forward, whether we think, you know, perhaps it was a mistake or that kind of stuff. So what do you have initial thoughts to kick us off?
Yeah, I mean, the average of $10 per month, it sounds to me like that's really targeted at the consumer side of the market. And I would look to see if maybe there's a possibility of going after businesses who need some sort of an online portfolio. So like a photographer, there's a photographer that we use every year here in Worcester who takes pictures with Santa Claus, for example. And so he has this whole website where you can go out and you can pick the photos and things like that. But I wonder if targeting photographers like that are running a small business would be a better proposition than targeting like end users or the consumer market, because obviously like those people are not going to be willing to pay very much money on a monthly basis for very long.
I think this does target more photographers, to be honest, and if you think of photographers, they're really like prosumers. If you want to know the truth, you know, they're not even SMBs, like beta SMBs. They're a lot of them do it as a hobby, and a lot of them do it on weekends, and they make, you know, a few hundred bucks a weekend or something. So I think they're that in between, and there are so many portfolio sites. That's what this site does. Pretty basic. And, you know, the headline is create a portfolio website quickly and beautifully. So it's kind of like you think of it as a Squarespace for just portfolio sites, and it's highly focused on that. But a lot of other sites do exactly this functionality, you know, so it's
really more a matter of like overcoming the competition, and especially if those other sites are offering it for free.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I don't know if they offer the exact same thing for free. I mean, certainly he has a free plan and then has the $10 a month upsell, which probably gets you something else. But I think the questions to think about is your offering pretty much exactly what a bunch of other places have, like Smug Mug or whatever? And if it is, you either need to be differentiated as a product in a way that people care about, or you need to have essentially a traffic or a lead source that no one else really has access to, right? Or that you are at the top of, like Google search results, or you're way better at paid ads and you're really getting a nice bit of traffic for that. For this won't work for paid ads because with the free plan and the 10 bucks a month. But it's like, if you don't have one of those two in this type of business, you're done. You're never gonna get above a grand plateau or $2,000 or whatever. There's gonna be some very small number of people who just decide, they just pick you because they found you first. But other than that, you either have to be differentiated or have to really own that traffic source, like that number one Google search result.
Well, I wonder if there's another option here, which would be to use this as your traffic source and then have something else that you're upselling. Because if hosting the portfolio is very much a commodity and there's other sites out there that are doing it for free and you're trying to charge for it, that's going to be a tough road. And obviously, like with $1,000 MRR, that's the position that he's in. But if you have something else that is something that you could sell, whether it's an ebook or some sort of an upsell on top of what you have now. And I'm not saying go back and retract the pricing and everything, but if there were some other product that you're upselling people to, like, hey, you build your portfolio and then we can educate you on how to grow like the traffic or advertising or things like that. There's other things I think that you can do here other than charging directly for hosting the portfolio, especially if that's the commodity. Like, is there some other product that you can have that you can put in there?
Right. I think that's a totally reasonable idea. I think another thing to think about is 30,000 free people have checked it out, right? I'm sure they're not active. I'm sure it's a small percentage. You have essentially 100 paying customers at 10 bucks a month to your 1,000. So that's 1/3% of all of your free users have ever paid you any money, or at least our current customers, I guess I should say. So that's a problem because that number is too low. That number should be between 1% and 3%. And so I would look at that and think, is there a way that I can get more free users to upgrade, or is the free plan just a mistake? You know, is the free plan just or a failed experiment? Maybe is a better way to say it. I would consider it, if you're not already sending, you know, emails to get people to upgrade, if you're not already helping them get whatever it is to get them to the paid tier or convince them that it's worth their value, then obviously that would be where I would start, because that number is too low. And it either means that you're not taking the right steps to get them to upgrade, or they're just never going to upgrade and the free plan is a waste of time. And so you need to figure that out. If the free plan's a waste of time, then I would shut it down immediately. And I would grandfather people in for now, and then I would start a free trial instead and do it basically the same way, where you have maybe 14 days or 7 days or whatever, and you have the emails with the, and then you have time pressure for people to kind of get in and get set up, and that helps them actually get value from the product. And I think you'll convert potentially more people in the short term. Then over time, you can consider, you know, when I acquired Hittail, there was a free plan and there were some users using a lot of resources that were on this free plan. And I did wind up shutting that down. And that was it was a hard decision, but the site was kind of bleeding money because of that. And I did get some people to convert from the free plan. It was not a huge number, but it did relieve a lot of resources from the app. And it, you know, allowed me to get some revenue. It was 500 or 1,000 of MRR in the early days of that. Actually, it may have been a little more than 1,000, but which sounds like chump change at this point, but it was actually, you know, a move that I think was worth it. I got some pushback. I did grandfather some people in who had been kind of fans of the site and really good, you know, JV partners, or that one guy had taught an SEO class in Italy and he had always been mentioned Hittail on the class. And so yes, just if someone complains and they're not disrespectful and they have a good reason, like, yes, you can keep them in, but to have 30,000 open free accounts on your platform, if you are going to kind of shut that thing down long-term, is just doesn't make a ton of sense.
To kind of add on to that a little bit, go back to the point that you said, what does it take to upgrade people? You can look at the number of images that people are uploading, the number of pieces of content, and try and see how many people are above that threshold and kind of where, like, what the average number of images that people upload is. So if it's, I'm looking at the subscription options and it says upload as many as 1,000 items. Well, how many do people upload on average? Is it 50, 100, 500? I mean, could you tweak that number and drop it down? And as Rob said, are there trigger points that you can use to say, hey, you're getting close to this. Would you like to upgrade? Look at those and see if you can play with those numbers a little bit to try and get people to more towards that edge where they have to make a decision one way or the other.
Totally. Yep. I think that's a good point. I think lastly, I'll reiterate, if you don't have some type of feature or positioning differentiation from most of the other platforms on the market, or you don't have some marketing advantage where you're getting leads at a, you know, that aren't comparing you to other people. So you, example, you are the number one search result in Google for some, you know, nice term, then long term this business is not going to grow. It's going to plateau somewhere, and it's probably going to plateau very low. And so that's something I would keep in mind. Our next question is about when to spend money on help desk software specifically, but I actually think it opens up almost a thought of, like, when do you start spending money on external SaaS apps when you're starting your own business? And this is from Safiya, and he says, hey guys, I discovered the show a few weeks ago and I cannot stop binging. Such a good resource for a first-time founder like me. What is your take on help desk software costs and how early we should put them in place? We've launched our SaaS MVP a few weeks ago as a free trial, and our prospects are rightly providing feedback and feature requests by email, which makes me crazy as the only developer in our company. I want to subscribe to Intercom or Zendesk or Groove, but my co-founder disagrees because of cost and thinks we should just deal with email for now. What is the right way to deal with feature requests at an early stage? I will throw one other support software in there, and that's Help Scout. We use them at Drip, and they worked really well for us, and they're quite cheap. I mean, I think all these things are what, 10 or 15 bucks a seat. So with that couched, Mike, it sounds like he has a couple questions, right? It's like, when to spend on help desk, and then there's kind of, how do you handle feature requests at an early stage?
Yeah, these are, I'd say, three different things that you can kind of dive into. And in terms of looking specifically at a help desk, one other thing that I'd throw out there as an option is a teamwork desk. And if you go over to teamwork.com/startups, they have a startup program where you can get everything that they have for free for an entire year. And it's not that they're Teamwork Desk's product is all that expensive anyway. I mean, you can get in on the ground floor at $5 a month, but, you know, you can get it for free if you need it, if you're just getting off the ground. So that's an option as well. In terms of when you should start putting things in place, I think that's more of a general question. And I would say that, like, when it becomes painful, if you get to a point where whatever problem you're trying to solve is taking too much of your time and effort, and it's cutting into your time and resources to do other things, then you really need to bite the bullet and start paying for it.
Yeah, I think handling support in the early days via a single, like, shared Gmail account is not, it's not out of the question. It's not terrible. I think you're going to want to get out of it quickly, but I think it's feasible if you're super cash strapped. However, look at a product like Fogbugs that is $20 a month for, I think, 4 or 5 seats. I know it's, in my opinion, it's not the caliber of Zendesk or of Groove, or I'm sorry, Help Scout or of Groove. Zendesk, to be honest, I'm not a huge fan of, but it's just a big cumbersome tool. But those are about $15 a seat. And so they are a little more expensive. And it depends on how big your team is. You know, if there's 5 of you and it's $75 a month and you really are cash strapped, there's a point where that money could be used for something else. So I think that handling feature requests specifically, handling them via email, but then having them, you need an issue tracker, right? I mean, even if you were handling it in a Gmail thing, you should still have be using GitHub issues, or you should be using, what are the other issue trackers out there, Mike? The Jira, you know, I mean, just anything like that. So, you know, you can move stuff from email into those trackers as you move them around. You don't have to manage them in email. That's crazy.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't manage them. I use Teamwork Desk for kind of my front end support. And then whenever something comes in where I'm going to essentially decide to promote it to like something on the roadmap, or if it's a bug, I tend to close them out and then move them over into Fogbugs, which is what I use for bug tracking for Bluetick. And it's just because you don't want to leave those tickets open for an extended period of time, because it's not helpful to them and it's not helpful to you. Like, they're basically sitting there, and it's not about the cost of the space. It's about the fact that they are sitting there as like another line item that later on you're going to have to go in and close out. Like, just tell them, hey, we've logged this, it's in our bug tracker, we'll get it fixed, and then close it out and move on. Because you don't want to have to track in two places is really what the issue is.
Right. And to give everyone context, like with my first product, .NET Invoice, I did all the support straight out of Gmail. When I got a business partner with that, we shared the Gmail account for a few months, and then it became a pain in the butt. So we moved to Fogbugs. And I was on Fogbugs for years. And then when we launched Drip, I believe, we moved everything into Help Scout, which I liked a lot. And then when we got acquired, LeadPages was already using Zendesk. And eventually we consolidated in Zendesk. And like I said, I'm not a big fan of Zendesk. It's pretty clunky and hard to use. But that's the progression I've made. And, you know, again, some of those are less expensive than others. And I do think that if it's working and you can manage and you guys are super cash strapped, then you can make things work. But that would be an early kind of bootstrapped situation that I would look to get out of as quickly as possible. So thanks for your question, Safiya. I hope that was helpful. Our next question is about EU legislation insanity is the subject line of the email. It's from Juka from closetodesigns.com. And he says, hi guys, are you aware of this? And it's a link to a Business Insider article. The title is 75% of cloud apps are not ready for new EU data protection rules. And Juka continues. He says, it seems they're threatening businesses with megacorp level fines for some vague, quote unquote, non-compliance, but they're imposing their rules on small companies too, of course. Does it seem like they're trying to kill small businesses? This seems like potentially an anti-business move. What is your take?
This is interesting because Juka sent over a link to the Business Insider story that was talking about this. And I looked into it a little bit, and you can make all the arguments or judgments you want about politicians and their ability to interpret how things are going to impact small businesses, especially when it comes to anything that's technology related. But the bottom line on this particular article is that if you look at the study that came out for this, it's by a company called Netskope. And if you go over to Netskope's website, they are trying to sell people on a solution to this particular problem. So, you know, it's almost like they self-commissioned this study so that when a CEO of a company, they're having a discussion with this person and saying, hey, well, you need to pay attention to this law. And he's like, well, what? Why do I need to pay attention to this? Oh, here's this study that you can look at as a reference, and here are all the problems that you could possibly run into. And it's like, it's basically this giant marketing collateral piece that they put together solely to scare those CEOs and executives into purchasing their products and services. So I don't see it as much different than some of the security vendors. I mean, they're really trying to sell based on this position of making people fear what is going on or what could potentially happen, and saying, hey, we have a solution to this particular problem. I don't know if it's something that most small businesses are probably going to need to pay too much of attention to. At its core, the whole thing is trying to consolidate different laws from all the different member states of the EU, and they're trying to consolidate it. So instead of having to follow 28 different sets of rules, you only follow one. I do understand that there's the, you know, contention about the level of the fines, but that's something that is, you know, like, you kind of have to go back to them and see, like, how serious are they about enforcing those things, and what is their stance, and why is that? Sometimes, like, government entities will really look the other way when you show that you're trying to do the right thing and you just screw it up. And then there's times where they'll nail you to the wall and you have to kind of interpret, like, is this the type of entity that will nail you to the wall, or are they just going to let things go because, you know, you're a certain size and you just didn't know any better?
Yeah, it's good you pointed that out about it, the report being sponsored by them. I wonder if the category that it's in Business Insider is called BI Intelligence. All of them are these reports from companies, and I can't find any evidence that they're sponsored. You know, they're sponsoring the BI articles themselves, the Business Insider articles, but I would not be surprised if that were the case. Yeah, and as we talked about a few episodes ago, there used to be Safe Harbor, and then EU changed it 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, and then they're now changing it again. So this thing is such a fiasco and you know, very hard to keep up with for someone that's not just mired in it. And having spent myself several thousand dollars on legal fees just to have contracts drawn up, I think it's just a big pain in the butt. It's not something that I have personally, beyond having just that contract written up, spent a ton of time kind of dealing with or investigating. Our next question is about how to promote a blog post. He says, "Dear Rob and Mike, how did you promote your blog posts in the early days of your SaaS? I'm interested in channels and methods." Yeah, this is a good question. And I think, I don't know, I think I would almost caution someone, like, there is value in having a blog for a SaaS app. But these days, given how noisy so many spaces are, like, unless you're speaking out in a way from the blog in a way that is unique, or that you're saying something different, it's probably not the first marketing approach I would do these days. Because so many people have followed the content marketing playbook of, you know, the playbooks of Kissmetrics or BidSketch or Groove. I mean, there's been people who've executed it really well and to great effect. Because of that, it's just gotten harder and harder. And so if you're kind of just cranking out 1,000-word blog posts on some topics, it's really probably wasted effort. I think you could get more customers elsewhere. With that said, if you have really unique content and you understand the game as it stands today, and if you notice now what Kissmetrics is doing, or if you notice now, you know, what Groove or I'm trying to think, Intercom, I think they do. There's several that do content marketing really well. It's these very, very long authority posts. So instead of doing, you know, a post every day or three posts a week, it's like one every week, one every 2 weeks, but they're really long and in-depth, and they kind of are trying to be an authoritative or a definitive view. Sometimes they're broken up into multiple pages. Sometimes it's all on one page, and they offer it's almost like an ebook that's published as a blog post. And Google has, you know, the tides have turned, and Google seems to like these things more. And as you build up equity over time, that's how you're going to do it. So with that in mind, it's a lower volume but higher quality play. There are a number of channels to kind of try to get traction. It's depending on your topic, right? You look at something like, you get on Hacker News. If you write something really interesting that everybody's going to be interested there, then of course you could promote it. Product Hunt, there's a section for this kind of stuff. Medium is still a decent source. You know, we had experimented on Drip with going Medium first, where Medium was the source, and then we republished on our blog post on our blog, and then we did the other way, and then we tried a bunch of different stuff, and that worked so. We never got enough of a following on Medium to justify it, and I really wanted the SEO juice, you know, over on our blog. But Medium and Twitter are obviously places where people are talking about things, and those are, you know, ways that you can get some eyeballs to come, as well as Facebook. Unfortunately, as I say, as I roll my eyes, Facebook and LinkedIn, both of those have, you know, obviously ways to get stories out, and then you can promote them for a small amount of money. And this is stuff you have to experiment with. You're going to know your niche. If you're at least a little bit B2C or B2 prosumer, you can, I've seen people use this to great effect on Facebook. I've seen people use it to great effect on LinkedIn when they're more of the kind of B2 enterprise or B2 mid-market. And so there's a couple things. It's not about just having this cookie cutter thing where you, every time you publish, you're going to submit to 26 different things and hope one of them catches. That's not going to work very well, because you're going to either get banned or you're just not going to get traction. It's going to be a waste of time. You really have to sit down and think about a unique piece of content and think about it as a one-off project, and then think about what are the best things of all the potential promotional areas I just mentioned, as well as there's certainly more. I bet if you search Google for how to promote a blog post in 2017, there are going to be more ideas that I did not just throw out. And then it's applying the few that you think are really going to work, but really digging into them. And so if you think it's going to be Product Hunt, for example, then I would spend 2 or 3 hours like figuring out how do you do this on Product Hunt. You know, I wouldn't just submit it and hope for the best. It's like, there's ways to improve your chances of that being successful. And I don't know them off the top of my head, because we had some success with Product Hunt, you know, when I was still running marketing for Drip, but I'm not an expert, but someone out there is, right? So that's, I think, how you have to think about it these days, is, you know, really being more kind of focused and spending more time than you would like, probably. And that's where I'm not so sure that, blogging is necessarily the way I would go if I had a SaaS app these days and I was just getting started. But it does certainly depend on your niche and where you're going.
I think I would ask why you're trying to use blogging, because I mean, you talked about this a lot, Rob, but like, what's the purpose of that? Like, are you actually going to be getting customers from that? And are you going to be heard over the noise? And are you going to be able to sustain the effort that it takes to continue publishing that new content? And I get that there's this weird relationship between the number of web pages that you have and your search engine rankings and your ability to draw traffic to your site. But is that going to be what's going to do it for your business? Like, is that the channel that you need? Or are there other things, other ways to get people to your website, whether it's doing speaking tours and getting backlinks from those or publishing on other people's blogs, for example? Like, that's a great one just because of the fact that if you can get published on somebody else's blog and they've already got a built-in audience, then you don't have to build your audience and you can get the backlinks from them. It's more sporadic, but at the same time, like, you don't have to do all that upfront work to build your own audience immediately.
I think that's a really good point. I think guest posting, JV partnerships, podcast tours, I think these are all things that will likely have more of an impact than just starting your own blog.
Well, I think that about wraps us up for today. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupstherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupstherestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.